Okay. Okay, no, I'll just keep going. I won't wait. Okay, hey, this is what we're covering. What is evangelism? When do we use it? What is this TCO thing? How do we calculate it? What is ROI? And how do we use it to boost Linux's fortunes in the enterprise? How do we develop open source procurement and risk management guidelines? How do we increase the uptake of Linux servers and workstations? This is presentation four. Essentially, you're either working in an environment where they're light on with regards to Linux, and you reckon that could seriously be boosted. This will show you how. Or you're a service provider, and you want to actually do the same thing for your clients. And no, this is nothing technical. All the kernel hacker talks next door, so if you're in the wrong place, leave now. Okay, what's evangelism? Just a very broad, everyone vaguely knows what it is, but essentially it's some kind of enthusiastic, persuasive techniques that you can use to get somebody to visualize your worldview. Okay, it's a mechanism for persuasion. Very early proponents in the technology sphere, it's been around for quite a while, but in the technology sphere, Apple have been very famous for using evangelism very seriously, very effectively. They've been doing it essentially since the initial Mac came out, and one of the main keynotes in their kind of organization in the 80s was a guy called Guy Kawasaki, who's very well known in the whole Silicon Valley context for doing evangelism. Most technology companies have got evangelists for particular product lines, okay, and I reckon there's a serious chance that with the right kind of mindset, that the whole Linux free software world can produce the best corporate Linux evangelism team that exists. Okay, it's not marketing. Okay, it's really a one-to-one communication between perhaps you, the evangelist, and somebody else you're trying to change the worldview of. It's not intended to sell somebody something. It's not sales either. Right? So people can generally see through sales and marketing. So this is not that. If done right, it's something that boosts the momentum, if you like. And if you're doing evangelism right, and you get somebody to see what you're on about, it's a big positive momentum push for yourself, for them, and also for whatever technology or idea that you're espousing. And when to use it? Okay, so you need to be in an organization with probably the following kind of attributes. They've got a bit of experience in Linux, but not a lot. Okay. They may have heard about the benefits, but they need a lot more information. They've got maybe possibly some thinly deployed Linux sites or boxes or what have you, but there's serious scope for an increase in that. Okay, how to use evangelism? Firstly, you need to really zero in on particular sectors. You could be in the corporate sector, you could be financial services, you could be in the military, you could be in the SME market, either as an employee or as a service provider, education and so forth and so on. One of the best ways to sort of do evangelism is to cite other people, particularly people who sound impressive. US Department of Defense, really impressive. So wherever you can, you find others who have done work in this area, and you zero in on interesting bits and pieces of their documents, reports, whatever that they've generated. And you clip that, and you start maintaining a bit of a database on it, or you're an excellent Googleizer, and you can find these things on the fly from Google whenever you need them. Extract whatever you can, quotes, figures, diagrams, references, that would help you in your efforts to evangelize Linux-free software. And remember, you've got to be an evangelist, not a zealot. There's a big difference. You have to really believe in the product. Now, I think I'd be safe in saying that pretty much everyone here would believe in the merits of Linux, free software, open source, whatever you want to call it. In most circumstances, we aren't doing this. We could be making a living out of it, but we're not really doing this to make a $1 billion. We're doing this because we really believe that this is an important technology or an important process, and it's also something that will also be very good for the particular target organisation we're looking at helping with regards to Linux and open source. Not all organisations will fit this template. Not all of them will be able to successfully deploy and, you know, make use of Linux-free software. And if you really believe that from up front, you'll become a more effective evangelist. And you never go around ever and suggest that, well, you know, your organisation or your network or your dimwit sysadmins aren't good enough to be doing stuff with Linux. Not good. Okay, consider the audience. You've got like three main thrusts of people. You got the non-Linux techies, whether they be at the one end, you know, Solaris, Windows, what have you. You've got the management bods, and you've got the money bean counters. So they're all different segments, all different interests, all different target points. To the non-Linux techies, what do you say? Okay, so what do you have to do? You have to allay their fears that Linux is a threat to them. Whatever way, shape, or form, you're going to do that. Right? So it's not too difficult to do that, but you have to make sure that that's covered. So perhaps you can do that by giving them pointers to interesting or useful articles or maybe tutorials on how they can go from Windows to Linux in three easy steps. Okay, so just really simple stuff. Anything that increases their appreciation of what Linux can do. Wow, geez, I didn't know that Linux could run SAP. Okay, so send them that little tidbit. You know. Anything that avoids just, you know, tit-for-tat, you know, pissing contest type stuff, avoid that. But on the other hand, make sure that they know that Linux means business. And the industry vibe is that Linux will not only be here and be highly competitive over the coming 5 to 10 years, but that it will be dominant. If they understand that, they'll know very quickly that they want to get and ensure that their job is still viable in 10 years' time, and they'll get with the program and learn Linux. And on the other hand, if you find bits that, yes, hey, you were right, you know, Linux doesn't do this well or whatever else, show them that too, you know. Okay, management bods, pointy head bosses. Okay, you need to send information that strongly indicates that for that particular government sector, corporate sector, financial sector, education, whatever, that Linux has strong uptick. There's a lot of interest. Send case studies. Managers love case studies. Send any information which improves or shows an improvement, financial, efficiency, whatever. These guys love that kind of stuff. Once again, don't shy away from sending them information that said, well, look, you know, Linux lost out in this particular instance. But if you can, dig deeper, do a bit of research. And this is one of my little favorites. It just shows you what you can dig up when you do a bit of research. Most of you would know that Microsoft is currently funding a pretty expensive anti-Linux advertising campaign. Anyone seen any of the ads on print or, yeah? I'd love to see one. The deal is, the core of this argument, they've got a bunch of reports, all of which except for two they've financed. And the core of this particular argument is this report that they financed from IDC. It came out about November, December 2002. Written mostly by a fellow who's always popping up on the news clippings, a fellow called Dan Kuznetsky. 4 months later on, in Business Week, which is not a pro-Linux publication, it's not an IT publication, read by management bods, Mr. Kuznetsky pops up with the following. And yeah, hey, well, Microsoft selected the particular environments, the particular scenarios, such that, yes, they would win out in our TCO calculations. I mean, that just kills off the whole report. That kills off, essentially, the core basis of Microsoft's anti-Linux big money spin at the moment. Right? So all you need to do is just have this little clipping handy. And every time somebody says, look, Microsoft's saying X, just respond with this. And there's the URL down the bottom for too. Okay, how do you get quotable quotes? You know, you guys all know this, but, you know, hey, Linux Weekly News, I don't know if John's in. I saw him down the riverbank before. You're in, John, hi. Linux Today, Google is pretty good nowadays too. News.google.com, go search Linux and sort on date. You'll get news clippings coming in by the minute, and they're useful. Zeroing on comments which you know sound effective, official sounding quotes from governments, from, you know, big organizations. You know, to hear that what was that, Lever and Kitchen, I think, were these huge conglomerates for moving whole lock, stock and barrel over the next few years to Linux. You know, get the CIO's quote. That's the kind of stuff to send around. When you're sending your stuff an email, add an appropriate little wrapper to say, hey, you know, this is interesting to you because, and put it in context. Send it on. Let's look at examples. Okay, this is something you'd send to a tech. IBM has done some work, very nice work. One of their fellows has done some work where there's like 9 separate tutorials to go from being absolute novice or no knowledge with Linux to being quite knowledgeable with Linux in the space of like a day. This is what you'd send to a Windows sysadmin. Here it is, all nice, all free, download it, print it, hand it across to them. You know, hey, you mentioned you're interested in Linux, you don't have time to learn it, have a look at these. Also, you send them information that makes sure that they understand that, you know, Linux is serious and it means business. So you send them the IT Week clippings and say, hey, you know that Microsoft popped up just 3 or 4 months ago and said, look, you know, we went commissioned all this research and Windows 2003 is faster than Samba 2. And a month later on, IT Weeks did a test with Samba 3 and it blew it out of the water. 250% faster on the same hardware by an independent research lab. Okay, what do you send management bots? You know, the standard Linux will dominate. If you can find them, copy them, paste them, send them on. So Goldman Sachs is a very well-known organization, particularly in financial circles. It's a big name. So you send something like that on, and that means something. What do you send the CFO? Now, the top one's pretty easy. Okay, we saved squillions doing stuff with Linux, $1,300 per seat per year. That's US dollars. Okay, show them how. But also importantly, now CFOs, bean counters, hate this wastage thing with software. So you can send them something a bit subtler that makes them personally make the connection. 2002, November the 4th. So Computer World Australia does this poll. You know, do you agree? Over the years, millions of dollars have been spent, you know, wasted on software which, you know, doesn't do the job. Hey, almost everyone said yes. 79% said yes. A week later, the question. Now, Linux will play a central role in my organization's IT infrastructure. Notice the numbers. They're almost identical. A week later. So you just set up in the financial controller's mind that all these people have gotten jack of paying too much for software which didn't meet their needs. A week later are saying, well, we're looking at Linux and we think that it can form a central part of our IT infrastructure, not a peripheral or a useful part, but central. Okay, we're not to use evangelism. You know, common sense. If they're already doing it, you know, don't beat the dead donkey. You know, they're doing it. You know, help them if they need help, but don't keep pushing. Okay, what's TCO? It's just pretty standard stuff, but nobody ever really agrees on what this TCO thing is. Okay, total cost of ownership, but who defines the goalposts? Well, depending on who you are, you can define it any number of different ways, but let's just say, for argument's sake, that you've got, okay, acquisition costs, integration costs, hardware licensing, what have you. Ongoing operational costs, everything from lighting, power, whatever other infrastructure costs, you know, wages costs, consultancy fees, you factor those things in. Now, most of the analysts don't have a standard model which includes mopping up after viruses or system downtime. Okay, do you reckon if they added those things in, Windows would ever come out in front? Okay, what's the return on investment? How quickly can you make the money that you've just invested in your IT back? Right. So it's pretty simple. Let's just look at some more detailed versions of this. I reckon that ROI is probably a more useful mechanism to use as, I'll be blunt and sort of call it a crowbar of getting Linux and free software into corporates. You know, these guys understand ROI. You know, spend $50,000 and in 12 months, 24 months time, I'll give you back $150,000. If you can show this to them, if you can prove it, you've got them hooked. Okay, forget about everybody else's TCO, do your own. It's pretty simple, a day's work, and you've got some meaningful figures rather than, I won't say the names, analyst figures. you know, it's not difficult to do. I'll give you a template to do it too. List all the costs associated with acquiring the technology, and also, not trying to be cheeky, because I think this is very important. I made the same point at the open source government thing the other day. Factor in the costs of migrating out of that environment. End of life cycle cost. You know, yes, you've gone off and put all the data you've got into Exchange Server. Now, get it the hell out. How are you going to do that? You dump it into SendMail, you dump it into whatever else. You know, it's a piece of cake to pull it out. Okay, so the migration costs away from that piece of technology are pretty low. Open standards, open platforms always win. If you can factor that into your TCO, that's a clincher. Okay, there's your sample TCO documents. Hopefully everyone can do OpenOffice. Otherwise, just give me a hoy and I can dump it into RTF or something else. By the way, bottom, Microsoft pricing, nice and easy, from the horse's mouth. Do your own ROI. So firstly, you really need to have your TCO in place. And you know, realistically, we're talking, for the most part, in the space where most of us will be playing, we're talking x86 boxes, we're talking Windows, we're talking Linux. So you do your TCO analysis on Linux, you do your same thing again for Windows. Okay. You come up with a figure. So if you can't be bothered doing that, calculations are that if you amortize and roughly average out all the TCOs that are floating around on the web, you'll get something that, if you cover server, infrastructure, desktop, for a medium-sized organization, you know, bookend, 50 people, 500 people, you're looking at about 20% in Linux free software's favor. So you grab that figure, and then you figure out how much it would cost you to migrate particular platforms. Really simple stuff. This is, you know, kindergarten mathematics. You grab the $100,000 migration cost, and you've got the yearly TCO for these systems that you're migrating away from of $200,000. So at a 20%, one fifth of $200,000 is $40,000. It'll take you 2.5 years to recoup that investment. After that, every successive year, you make $40,000 back for the company. Now, in recent times, 2.5 years is a bit of a stretch. So what you need to do, well, actually what this does do for you, it defines the lay of the land. Some migration projects might be too expensive in terms of ROI, and some might be a lot easier and you get much, much faster ROI. And they're the ones to do first. Okay, you know, serious companies should have some form of risk policy, risk best practice, whatever you want to call it. Not just for open source. You know, I've been noticing recently that, you know, oh, well, we have open source, it could be risky. We should have some policies for it, right? Well, damn it, you should have some policies for all your software. Because if you did, then you'd notice that open source ain't that bad. Because, yes, you shouldn't allow anyone to just download anything off the internet. And, it's not just an open source thing. And just as importantly, where are we? We have to. Yeah, that's the thing, right? So I've been having too much in the way of people push the argument of we don't get any indemnification and warranties with the whole free software thing, but realistically you don't get much of that with the proprietary software. Although in the past 6-7 months they've been making some noises along those lines. But I don't think they would have been making those noises along those lines if it wasn't for the fact that free software is essentially identical with regards to indemnification and warranty. And therefore, for the money that these guys are charging you, they're having to give you something for it, something extra. There's a piece that came out from a fellow at Red Hat, I think he's their chief lawyer, which is a very reasonable first pass at a risk management policy for an organization. Just grab it, copy, paste, make some amendments as you need it. Do not permit the uncontrolled downloading and installation of software. Pretty standard. Just as importantly, stop the use of proprietary software except to the extent that the company can account for the permitted licenses. You don't have that license for Microsoft Office? Delete it now. What can you put on it? Well, we just happen to have OpenOffice 1.1. Right? That we can install. Okay, know how the software will be used. You know, so none of this bogeyman stuff. Oh, it's open source, and all the people here, our users will modify the code, and will be, you know, GPL violations everywhere. Absolute rubbish. You know, most people wouldn't touch the source code. Right? So know how the software is going to be used. You don't make any code mods, and you don't invoke any repercussions with regards to license compliance. If you do, then track it, just like you would with any other proprietary licenses. Okay, and also audit all the stuff. Just build a catalog, make sure it's all there. Okay, what's the alternative? Is it any better with regards to the whole risk mitigation thing? No. Okay, copy, paste, Windows XP license. You can read it as well as I can. Microsoft and its suppliers' entire liability, and your exclusive remedy shall be at Microsoft's option. I like that, at their option. From time to time, exercise subject to applicable law, yada yada, the return of the price paid, if any. A, and B, repair or replacement of the physical product, not the actual binary code. You know, if it's broken, bad luck. Yes, we'll replace the hard disk, sorry, the CD-ROM, but not the actual broken software. Okay, in other words, if you paid no license costs, just like as you would with open source software with zero licenses, you're essentially back in the same square one. There's no difference. Okay, now, a lot of these organizations, particularly the larger ones, have got a pretty good handle of how to acquire proprietary technology, because they've been doing it for decades. But they have generally far less of a handle of how to acquire open source technology. So you can do a lot to help them with this. Okay, so, you know, you have an intuitive feel for what is a viable project or what is a good project, right? They don't. And you can help them out, one or two pages, quick notes to say, look for these things, and it'll give you an indication whether or not this is viable technology or not. Simple things like, you know, check the user support mailing lists. Are they active? What's the feedback? Check the developer activity levels. If you go to the website and the code hasn't been changed in 3 years, that rings alarm bells. You know, check the support responsiveness. Talk to users. Get the feedback going. Also check project roadmap. A lot of the you know, competent and major open source projects have got pretty serious roadmaps. You know, Eclipse, in 6 months' time we're going to be doing X, Y, and Z, and they'll generally hit those milestones, right? Okay, now, so you've convinced these guys to go with a bunch of Linux stuff. Great. What do you do next? You're going to do it professionally. You're going to make sure this thing is done by the numbers, because not only, you know, that generally will increase the likelihood that you'll succeed, but more importantly, it provides a safety harness if you foul it up. We did it by the numbers, but something went wrong, and, you know, there's not much we can do. But you can do the same thing with any kind of technology, not just a free software technology. Okay, let's look at some, I hate heavyweight stuff, heavyweight procedures, I'm not a procedure person. Let's look at some really lightweight things that you can provide a safety harness for your migrations. Okay, server migrations, preparing for it. Select those really light-end systems, those kinds of things that you can just drop in, replace, DNS, proxying, what have you, as the first port of call. Now, do this whole business case thing. Why are we bothering to do this? You know, well, it's running, you know, Microsoft DNS, and it's running there okay. Why are we replacing it with something Linux? It might be because the hardware is failing, and you need to go get a new version of, a new copy of the hardware, and the new hardware doesn't run with Windows NT version 4 because it doesn't have the supported. So this is your business case. Just document it all so people know why you're doing it. It's not because you love Linux. It's because there is a very specific reason for you to be doing this. And this is what makes business sense. Okay? Well, you can be convincing along those lines. That's what you put down. You know, or you could say, well, you know, we reckon that Squid's got better security features than whatever was there beforehand. And that could be a justification for doing it. Document it all. Okay, audit the existing systems. You have to know where everything goes, backwards and forwards, because if you install something over the top and what was there was kind of sort of working and you muck it up, it'll be Linux which is blamed. Oh, you put this Linux thing in and, like, you know, suddenly our databases aren't working through the firewall anymore. Oh, geez, we didn't sort of check out where all the, you know, the packet filtering ports were going and what was allowed and what wasn't allowed, and, well, that's your foul up. It's got to be fixed well before you make those kinds of changes. Also, give a bit of a mental image of what's going to happen after this whole thing has migrated. What's it going to look like? right? This is what we're trying to achieve. This is our baseline. Roll out and roll back. If it fouls up, you can go back to where you were on Friday before everyone comes back on Monday morning and screams at you. Trial it if you can. If you don't have the appropriate hardware, trial it on VMware. You know, just a couple of virtual machines, networking, you know, bridge the whatever you do with VMware. I don't really know how the damn thing works, but no, it does work. Right? So you can essentially mimic what you're going to be doing and check it all out. Check the config file, you know, the config stuff out, make sure it all works. Make sure that your non-Linux techs are comfortable with what you're doing. Right? Not just you. Right? If you know what you're doing, it's all good. Make sure they're up to speed with it. If they are up to speed, push the go button. You know, flight, we are go. After 3 months, check it out. How did it compare with what we were planning? Did it meet our vision? Hopefully, yes. Okay, now let's go for the whole post-migration thing. Prepare a report to management. Management, we did good stuff. You know, in 6 months, 12 months' time, this thing will be saving us 10% on what we were doing beforehand, which is like $4,000. That's a plus. Now make sure that those little successes are well known. Don't hide it. Don't hide the fact anymore. This is not 5 years ago, it's now. Get feedback from the non-Linux techs that helped you with this thing. You know, did you like it? Was it fun? What do you want to do next? You know, pick an application server. Pick a VPN. Pick a database. If they do pick some esoteric stuff, like, you know, IPsec, that's so hard, give them some background papers on it. Point them some stuff. Get them knowledgeable on it. And then just go back to the previous step and repeat the whole thing again. And something else you want to do before you do all this is, our good friends in Europe have popped up with this IDA migration guidelines document, which if you haven't read, I'll save you for it. You should read it. It's really good. It's 150 plus pages. Actually, I was supposed to open it up and pray read, but I won't bother. But anyway, it's a nice document. It gives you essentially a big, you know, non-distilled version of this presentation, right? This part of the presentation. But here's some of the stuff that it talks about. You need to know what you're doing and why you're doing it. You need to ensure that there's support from the appropriate people. You know, if you can find this concept of a champion somewhere up the food chain, you know, ring them in. You know, make them a fan. Build up expertise with a particular group if you're using particularly esoteric technology. You know, you don't really need to build up, you know, rapport with the Apache group because, you know, the damn thing just works. And, you know, you don't start off on critical systems. You know, if you want to have failures, you have failures on things that nobody will notice. And make sure you're in control every step of the migration. Okay, and if you're getting more complex migrations, make sure you answer some of these questions too, specifically with things like security, built-in security from ground up, things like roaming users and so forth, and interoperability. Okay, now, the harder sell. Same deal selling the concept of a Linux desktop. It can be done. Right? It's not a, you know, not a an impossibility. Use the same arguments, TCO arguments. You know, hey, fewer viruses. You know, lockdown desktops. The users can't do anything besides change wallpaper. All that stuff. Okay. And you can start off. Sorry, Liam. It is. Well, you know. Well, it's right. You can put stuff on the wallpaper, which kind of gets you in court, right? So. Okay, so the least, I'd say least Linux friendly, but let's just, you know, okay, Gartner in this space, in the management space, is reasonably well respected. So if you can roll up with this figure that Gartner reckons that Linux is 15% less expensive than Windows XP, they're like their current corporate flagship, that's ringing some bells, because 15% is not a bad saving in money. But, you know, isn't this whole Linux desktop thing too hard? You know, isn't it too complex? Can normal users use Linux? The answer is yes. A few months ago, you may recall this. There's this German research analyst firm that popped up with this report. Well, they got a bunch of essentially, you know, clueless users, normal people, off the street, and said, well, you sit down in front of a bunch of Linux boxes, and you sit down in front of a bunch of Windows XP boxes, and they got them to do all this stuff that they'd never done before, and there's the difference. Windows XP compared to Linux, there's an 8% difference in the usability slash efficiency of time. Okay. And the interesting quote down the bottom, 80% of the users of the users who use Linux for the first time believe that they would be proficient and competent at it after only 1 week. This is like no training. Okay, you plan for Linux desktop migration very much like the server. It's a lot harder in a sense because, as you know, the network effect applies here. On the server, nobody knows what you're doing, and you're only touching two or three sysadmins. On the desktop, you're touching a whole bunch of different people, and it's the appropriate x squared law with regards to this as well. You've got all these different quote unquote stakeholders. So what you need to do it very measured and very carefully. You need to plan it out, and this may be something that goes 6 months, it might be something that goes 36 plus months, but you need to factor that in from the beginning. So your management has to know this. You're not going to go do this big gloop change that's going to cause a whole bunch of people to scream, because they won't allow you to proceed. And finally, as we'd all know, it's very difficult for any medium-sized or large-sized organization to be completely Windows-free. Not now, maybe in 5 or 10 years' time. Okay, so you defined who it is within this organization, this target organization, who could possibly, move across onto a Linux desktop. It might be call center, help desk, it might be admin, it might be marketing. People who have very specific, constrained line of business requirements. Okay, they'd have to have the following kinds of attributes. The applications would need to have functional equivalents available for Linux. Data would need to be not only migratable across, but also continue to remain interoperable with what currently exists throughout the remainder of the organization. This is all perfunctory stuff. It's all plain and simple as you'd expect. Now, you can go do quite a lot on this to make it happen. Like, you can meld or you can formulate templates in things like OpenOffice.org, such that they're essentially identical and they open up identically in both OpenOffice and in Microsoft Office. And you can create templates that are not, but you can do the job such that they are. So therefore, this organization with some staff who are using OpenOffice and some staff using Microsoft Office essentially feed off the same backbone of templates for faxes, for invoices and whatever else. You can use interoperability tools, things like Crossover Office. To give you an idea, so Crossover Office will run most of your mainstream, big end apps, Windows, Microsoft Office 2000, what else is running? QuickBooks, Photoshop, all that kind of stuff. Okay. Now, there's a ballpark figure. I just took the pricing off their US website. It's about $3,500 US, $5,000 Australian, give or take, for 50 concurrent users. Now, most of the time, a lot of these users won't be using Office off this Crossover Office server. So it's like a client-server arrangement. They won't be using the software most of the time. So you could have 200, 300 staff who use, essentially, or have available to them this technology, but only 50 of them use it concurrently. So the cost per desktop goes down to something like $10, $20, $30, $40 a desktop. And you don't need Windows licenses, right? So if you're facing Windows 98 is dying, and I can't get Office XP to run on anyway, issue, this is the cheapest way to do it. This is what convinces management. Okay, same as with server migration process. Once again, because there's more at stake here, you plan and document everything from the get-go. It also makes management far less anxious. If you can, do a whole pilot phase thing. Pick out a couple of the really sharp people within that group and say, okay, we've got something really new we want you to play with and we want your feedback on. What do you think of this? This is the start button, the little foot or the little K, and everything else, the icons and so forth, you know. And what you do is, the best way to do this is to work out a phased migration, even at this level, very granular. So what you do is, first up, you say, Internet Explorer, security, blah, blah, blah. How about we put the latest version of, Mozilla on, or whatever the current name for it is. And you set up all their bookmarks, and you transfer all the stuff across, and so forth and so on. And you do the same thing for mail, and you get that working off IMAP. And then a few months later on, you say, look, you know, you guys are going to be playing around this new word processor called OpenOffice. And you set the icons up and so forth and so on. And after a few months, if nobody's screaming, you change the operating system and they won't notice. Right? You set the icons up in exactly the same spot. That's all it takes. Okay, user resistance. I love this. Users. Okay, so if you're one of these fascist organizations where, you know, MIS God says, it will be so and it's so, then hey, lucky you. If you're not, how do you get user buy-in? Well, you can be creative. Right? You can be creative, right? So if you've got, like, you know, Department X is billed by, you know, the IT group for work, you can say, well, Department X, we'll move you across to Linux and we'll cut your bill, monthly bill, down by a factor of, you know, insert value here. And they'll say, well, we're interested. Talk to us about it. Okay, individuals. Okay, users love training. Well, we've got this new platform. You know, we'll get you training. It might be in-house training, fine. And we'll print up some nice little certification with a nice little company logo. Users love that kind of stuff. This is the one I really like. This one really moves mountains. Move to Linux, we'll give you $500. Right? You don't need to do anything else. Very few will say no. Okay, move to Linux. Just after we do this desktop Linux migration, you get a holiday. How many will say no? They come back and it's still Linux. They can't go back to Windows. Okay. Hey, I did it bloody fast. Sorry, I probably did it too fast. This is the second last slide. Don't just do evangelism. It's been done to death. Actually do something. Get out there and actually sell these ideas. Sell these steps. You know, write proposals. Make some noise. If it doesn't happen this month, it might be next month, next quarter, next 6 months from it. But it can happen, right? Okay, remove emotion from the equation. You know, do the Zen penguin thing. This all makes business sense. If it doesn't, don't suggest it, because otherwise it's, you know, your vanity kind of thing, your vanity project. No good. It has to make business sense for these people. The technology pieces are pretty much all in place. Not for everything, not across the board, not across the desktop, not across groupware, but mostly, for most situations, most organizations. It's now up to essentially you guys and people you can collaborate with to make this a reality and to mainstreamize Linux very seriously. That's it. We're up. Hey, I made time, right? Hey. You're all stumped? Okay, catch you later. Nah, come on. Gonna be questions. Anyone? Anyone? Up the bat. Look, depending on your distro and also depending on the kind of technology you're using, but you'll notice that there's this new Linux company, I believe, called Novell, that has a desktop and a very apparently very good one called, actually just by coincidence, Zen, I think, that they are moving into the Linux space. So if you are of the appropriate corporate caliber kind of organization that feeds into that realm, then that's what you'd look at. And I believe other organizations, possibly people like Computer Associates, also do something in that space. Right? So you've got 500 people and people don't mind paying a bit of a mint. Absolutely beautiful. The rest of it, you know, you seriously look at doing things like automated apt-gets or apt-get RPMs and yum servers and whatever else you use, and you package up all your configuration as, you know, as dev packages or RPMs. You use that approach. Right? So I don't know if that answers your question fully, but there's your geek solution, which generally works, and the corporate solution, which business people, high-end business people like, but costs a packet, but probably also still works. Anyone? Sorry? Okay, so the question is once again with regards to indemnity. And that probably would have been me talking about having a separate third-party entity to cover you for... Right, so a service provider to fill in the knowledge gaps that that particular organization doesn't have. That's always been the case. And I guess according to my kind of rough gut feel estimation, there are probably 200 Linux open source service providers around the country. So it's not huge, but they're reasonable numbers. And most states, most terrains would have competent Linux service providers. And one of the things we're going to be looking at later on this evening, if anyone's actually interested, I forget exactly where, if anyone actually knows, I don't know if David's here, David Lloyd? Left bank, somewhere straight, and then I won't tell you because I'll get it wrong, but if you look for me later on, we'll have actual address details and so forth for a meeting we're having specifically for service providers. But in answer to your question, yes, you know, so you, I guess as a community, as an organization, whatever, we could do a lot more to make it known that there are viable solution providers to help organizations out, to take away the risk of, you know, not knowing what they're doing with installation of Linux and whatever else. So I don't know if that answers your question. Close enough? Yeah. Ah, that old Furphy, yes. Okay. The whole group with you. Yep. That's one of the bits on the previous slide where we're almost there with all of this kind of stuff. So there isn't really like a full-on, complete, 100% drop-in replacement. Leon will probably come up with something right now, but yeah. How good is that? Does anyone actually use Open Groupware? Anyone? Yep. And that's what happens, right? So we could be looking at a very viable... Sorry? Yes. Liam was just saying that a few months ago there was a big open source package released, which was an old code base that they'd been trying to bring up to date called Open Groupware, which essentially was very close to a concept of a drop-in replacement, functionally at least, if not completely interoperably from a protocol layer, a drop-in replacement for Microsoft Exchange. Now, the big problem was it was a very complex install, but obviously Mandrake has gotten to a point of including it as like obviously an RPM as part of the standard. So apparently it's quite functional, but the install was a big hill to climb. But now that's been removed and a lot of other things will probably be polished with it as it gets used. Yep. Yeah, that's the only... But, and this is a Colab, which is actually, I believe, funded by the German government to develop it on Colab. Sorry, yeah? K-O-L-A-B, Colab. They did, yes. So OpenMail does a pretty close facsimile. But Carnegie Mellon, yeah, I know. I'm having essentially the same discussion and argument with people at SEA National at the moment. But anyway, it's tricky, I guess. You wouldn't normally... Sorry? The question is, how do you deal with instances where an organization says, we'll only deal with vendors who are CMMI certified? Now, CMMI is the Capability Maturity Model I, whatever the I is. Which is out of a software engineering think tank in Carnegie Mellon Uni. It's essentially the kind of thing where offshore outsourcing companies pop up and say, well, we're CMMI certified, so we have attained a certain level of mediocrity. Right? It's McDonald's. You know, it's not great, but it's like it's at the 55% mark, and it's just over halfway. But you always know what you're going to get, no matter where you go, and that's what it is. It's the McDonald's of. It's primarily it's a process thing, not a product thing. So normally you'd go to a CMMI organisation and you'd hire them to do work for you, and that's when the CMMI thing comes through. But generally, for a finished product or open source project, you know the final result, and you can analyse that. It's either good enough for you, and it does the deal, and you can do your appropriate risk analysis, talk to people, does it work, or it isn't. So normally the CMMI thing doesn't come in when you've got complete finished technology, but only when you're hiring someone to build something for you. That's how I perceive it. But I'd be interested if you've got alternative responses from corporates as to why they believe CMMI is necessary when you're dealing with technology products. You get that, yeah. But look, I guess, but if you have particular instances where that's popped up, can you come and chat to me later on? I'd be interested to hear from them to sort of see what the tack was. Sorry, any... Yep. And you can do the TCO. So we're talking about the difference between a hosted server situation. In this particular instance, the in-house Linux server was better TCO, but you could do that on a case-by-case basis. Whereas you could have another organization that has no technical skills, and the TCO costing wouldn't be worth their while to do that. So this is the case-by-case basis thing, and you have to be reasonable with that. You can't always have, always bring it in-house and always put Linux on it. So this is a bit where you can really gain credibility by, in that instance, it worked for you, but in another instance, it might not work for company X. Hey. Yep. Oh, so this is as a contractor service provider. Totally open business model. That's up to if you're in that business, you come up with a business model that works for you. I mean, we'd have a business model. I'm sure Tiki at Netcraft would have a business model. So if you're in that space at a service provider and a solution provider angle, then you'd come up with a model which makes sense for you as a company or as a consultant, and hopefully that's a viable business model that you can actually sort of sell into the customer base. And if it's good and well priced, then they'll buy into it. But I would make the point of go in there and sell, go in there and pitch. I know selling and pitching stuff isn't really in the mindset of technical people, which is why it's a good realm. But it's the way to get this stuff out in the mainstream. That's it. I don't want to piss the whipmaster off, so I'll shut down now.
Thanks, man. All right. Yep. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tom.